The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
The latest U.S. jobs report showed the economy might be cooling some, but not too much. Overall, employers added a net of 209,000 jobs for the month of June. That gain was the smallest in 2.5 years, but still indicated a healthy labor market. The unemployment rate fell slightly to 3.6%. That's near the lowest point in 50 years.
The average rate on the 30-year fix jumped 14 basis points today to 7.22%. That's the highest rate since last November. Rates had already begun rising last week, crossing over that critical 7% line, and that had a direct effect on mortgage demand. Earlier today on Squawk Box, the CEO of Compass Real Estate, Robert Refkin, said 7% is now the new normal.
In just the last hour, the U.S. has confirmed that it will be sending cluster munitions to Ukraine. Not an entirely palatable solution to many observers. But the White House says while these weapons do carry a risk to civilians, American cluster bombs are less of a risk to bystanders because U.S. bombs have a lower failure rate than those used by Russia. The National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, said there would be a much greater risk to the country if Russia is allowed to advance.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Stock indexes ended the week on a negative note as worries over coming Fed rate hikes and a slowing economy weighed on investors' minds. The futures market is pricing in a 93% probability of another Fed rate hike coming this month, and the possibility of one or two more rate hikes later this year, depending on the inflationary outcome. In the meantime, Treasury yields rose across the board this week, with the 2-year note back up to 5%, and the 10-year note and 30-year bond now over 4%, as the Treasury is in the market raising vast amounts of money to finance the government's massive deficits. In other news, the Russian government announced on Friday that the BRIC countries will introduce a new gold-backed currency, which will be announced at the coming meeting August 22nd. This could become the most significant development in international finance since 1971, when Nixon took the dollar off gold backing. It could weaken the dollar in global payments and ultimately displace the dollar as a leading reserve currency. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to a special edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Coming up on today's program, Jim Bianco from Bianco Research will be my special guest as we discuss everything from a possible recession, inflation, a Fed pivot, the national debt, and investment strategy. Later on, Chris Sheridan and Chris Poplava will be here with another edition of Smart Macro. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
The S&P 500 was down 1% this week, with healthcare down 2.8, materials down 1.9, and technology down 1.5. Real estate was the only positive sector this week as money rotated in based on favorable sales data as of late. For the key events on this holiday shortened week, it was mainly the economic data that influenced stocks and interest rates. There were other interesting stories to note, but the economic data moved the markets. So focusing on that, here were the big reports, starting off with the ISM numbers for June. The manufacturing index fell to 46 in June from 46.9 in May. Anything below 50 is a contraction reading. A recession in manufacturing is a likely scenario as the index has held below 50 since November and currently shows no sign of recovery yet. There was an improvement in new orders from 42.6 to 45.6, so it will be important to watch this indicator over the next few months for a possible recovery. A move below 40 would not be helpful and has been correlated with corrections in stocks. Some, like Moody's, anticipated a recovery based on Federal Reserve manufacturing surveys, but that didn't come. The IHS market manufacturing PMI also corroborated this report, showing that manufacturing dropped down to 46.3 from 48.4 in May. ISM services came later in the week, showing resilience in the services component of the economy, rising to 53.9 from 50.3, again, staying above 50. Within the components, business activity, new orders, and employment all were supportive of the rise. The growth marks the sixth month in expansion for services. Additional economic data on Thursday was the hot ADP private payroll report, which showed 497,000 private sector jobs were added in June. Jobs in the goods producing sector were up 124,000, while services sector jumped 373,000, which also corroborated the ISM report. Both the ISM data for services and the ADP report were key on Thursday in moving interest rates higher, sparking a small sell-off in stocks. The two-year note rose 7 basis points to 5.01%, and the 10-year rose 10 basis points to 4.04%. In addition to these moves in rates, the probability of a hike this month for the Fed looks all but certain, while probabilities for a second hike in November jumped to 46%, with September up to 27%. Interest rate angst was the deciding factor driving the sell-off in stocks, in addition to the run-up stocks have seen over the previous 2 months. Fears the Fed may be more aggressive to fight inflation yet in 2023, with more hikes continue to rise based on Powell's comments last week with other central bankers, in addition to the FOMC minutes that were released this week. The minutes for the June meeting showed a key passage that stated, almost all participants noted that in their economic projections that they judged that additional increases in the target federal funds rate during 2023 would be appropriate. Increases being plural, while the CME FedWatch tool still shows July is really the only anticipated hike at this time. Friday's payroll data helped cool the concerns of a hot job market, with non-farm payrolls increasing by only 209,000. The easing of the two-year yield reflected an easing of concerns versus the previous day that the Fed could be aggressive this year. However, the 10-year remained elevated to close to 4.06% for the week, given that average hourly earnings were stronger than expected, up 0.4% month over month in the report. The jobs opening JOLTS report showed a total of 9.8 million jobs available in May versus 10.3 in April. In other economic news, total construction spending was up 0.9% month over month in May after increasing 0.4% in April, showing renewed strength in single family construction and a pickup in demand. And again, shows why we've been seeing a resilience and recovery recently in the real estate sector in stocks. In other news this week, Tesla and Rivian impressed investors with their second quarter delivery numbers. The bank industry stocks rose early in the week, continuing off of the good stress test results from last and also plans to increase dividends announced this week for many. Finally, tensions continue to build between the U.S. and China, with the U.S. considering limiting access to cloud services, while China announced further restrictions to rare earth mineral exports for germanium and gallium on Wednesday, of which China controls 60% of the world's germanium production and 90% of the world's gallium, according to Reuters. I'll be honest, I had to look up the uses of these two, which are mainly employed in semiconductors, electronic circuits, LEDs for lights, glasses for use in optical devices, and measurement tools. Well, that covers this week in the markets. Next week kicks off the second quarter earnings season with the banks late in the week. But first, we'll get the June CPI reading early in the week. The theme there continues to be disinflationary, which has continued to support the equity rally, while the back of it yields this week reflects more aggressive Fed and global tightening could be coming. Up next, Jim Bianco, this week's guest technician.
Last year, I did not think there was going to be a recession. I didn't think we'd see a recession in the first half of this year. However, there are at least three indicators that I think are really worth paying attention to. The problem is they all have extended lead times. So the yield curve turned negative in July of last year. The last 60 years, every yield curve inversion has been followed by a recession. The catch is, on average, the time is about 19 months between the time when you get the inversion and a recession begins. Leading economic indicators down 14 months in a row. The last 50, 60 years, whenever that has happened and declined as much as it has, there has always been a recession. That turned negative late last year, has a lead time of about 9 to 10 months. And then last, lending standards were increased significantly late last year. Again, the lead time on something like that is at least 9 months. And when you think about it, it makes sense. If I'm a small business owner, yeah, my bank just increased lending standards, but I won't feel it until my loan comes due. So there's this progressivity that happens with all these indicators. And I just think that my take has been the second half of this year is where I think we'll see more slowing. The irony, of course, is it potentially is going to appear just at the point in time when most people stopped worrying about a recession.
To listen to this full interview, in addition to gaining access to all of our premium content airing during the week, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we are committed to helping you build, maintain, and preserve your wealth. Contact us today to find out about our comprehensive financial planning and asset management services. Whether you're planning for retirement, taxes, putting together an estate plan, or need assistance in managing a 401k, Financial Sense Wealth Management is here to help. Give us a call to speak with one of our certified financial planners or wealth advisors at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
As we begin the second half of the year, there are a lot of questions on the minds of investors. Will we be entering a recession this year? Will the Fed eventually pivot? Is inflation coming down? And is this the beginning of a new bull market? And of course, another issue nobody's talking about is the rising federal deficit and debt. Joining us on the program is Jim Bianco from Bianco Research. Jim, let's begin with one of the first things on the mind. I've seen, Bloomberg has a recession beginning in, I believe, this month, and others are saying we'll be in one by the third quarter. But we just got these job numbers on Thursday, which are causing a sell-off in the market on the day we're doing this interview. What's your view from what you're following?
Yeah, so let's first of all put a little definition on this. A recession is, there's a committee called the National Bureau of Economic Research, and it's six PUBA economists, and they determine whether or not we're in a recession. So recession is whatever they say is a recession. And the reason I brought that up is, let's all remember a year ago, we had negative GDP in the first and second quarter, and they said that was not a recession. And by the way, that's the first time ever we've had consecutive GDP quarters that has not been in a recession. And they largely said that because everything else, mainly jobs, was positive. We kept producing positive payrolls during that period. So I understand that, not only is Wall Street thinking that third or fourth quarter, you could see negative GDP. The Federal Reserve itself, as its baseline forecast, has negative GDP in the fourth and first quarters coming up in the next 6 months. But I think whether it's a recession really comes down to, do we see job losses? We have not seen that yet. And as you've pointed out, the day we're recording, we got the ADP report, and it showed 500,000 jobs was created in June. Now, ADP has a spotty track record at predicting what the payroll report will be the following day, but boy, 500,000 jobs is huge for that report. So we'll have to see if that does translate into any kind of strength. So could we see negative GDP numbers? Sure, we did a year ago. But if it doesn't come about with weakening payrolls, so what? A year ago, when we had the negative GDP, the Fed was raising rates 50 and 75 basis points at every meeting while we were having the negative GDP. So I really think that the tail of the economy really comes down to the labor market and whether or not we see weakness in jobs. Now, last thought on this, we've had 14 months in a row where the jobs report has beaten expectations. We'll find out the day after we're recording whether or not that comes to 15 or we finally have a miss. 225,000 is what the estimate is. But we have to, at minimum, see some signs of a weakening labor market before we can start talking about recession. And as of the day we're recording, there's very little signs that the labor market is weakening right now.
And Jim, how much of this is being kept afloat with all the federal spending? I want to get to this later on, but we just hit $32.3 trillion in debt and are on course to hit maybe $33 trillion by the end of the year. But the government is pushing a lot of money in the economy. How much of that is keeping this economy afloat?
Well, there's no doubt, we're talking about fiscal stimulus, and the federal government, unlike state and local governments, can borrow into a deficit. State and local governments have to balance their budget. So that is, they're borrowing, they're spending on programs, they're borrowing, and they're juicing the economy. So there's there's a lot of that that's happening. And at the same time that that's been going on, we've been having an inflation problem. I would actually argue because of it, we've been having an inflation problem. And the Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates. So that $32 trillion of borrowing is really racking up the interest costs for the government. This year, interest costs surpassed the Defense Department budget. So we're spending more to pay the interest on debt than we are to fund the military. Now, quickly, the Federal Reserve refers to this as fiscal dominance. And what that means, it's a fancy way of saying it doesn't factor at all into their calculation as to whether they should do with policy. They do not want to be hamstrung because the government borrowed a lot of money and it's got a lot of debt costs. So therefore, we would like to raise rates, but we can't. They don't factor that in. They will raise rates because they think inflation is a problem. If the debt costs become a problem, that's the federal government's problem to deal with. They could rein in spending anytime they want and try and bring that number down, but it's not the Fed's job to deal with. That's the way that they think about it. So if the Fed is still committed to raising rates and committed to fighting inflation, and the federal government is also committed to spending and borrowing like crazy, that interest cost number is going to continue to go up. And the only thing that's going to change that equation is when the market imposes some discipline on the federal government. Now, that's a fancy way of saying the bond market blows up, you know, interest rates skyrocket, drives everybody to one knee in the stock market. And then everybody says, you got to stop with the spending. You're killing everything. Well, the stock markets, other than the day we're recording, the stock market is up and, you know, interest rates have been manageable. So the market is not imposing discipline on the federal government. So I suspect they'll just continue to borrow.
And is this a situation, Jim, where you have almost two parts of the economy? You have the manufacturing side, which has been weak, but the service side is just blowing out on all cylinders, it seems.
Yeah, that's definitely the case. You know, manufacturing is always going to have a difficult time because the business of making things has a foreign governments or foreign countries in order to compete with. You can make things cheaper in China. You can make things cheaper in Indonesia or Vietnam. So if you're in the business of making things, you've always got to compete with them. And that's always going to make that business a bigger struggle. If you're in the business of providing services, you kind of have to do that on premises if you want to. You know, some services I could maybe get from overseas, but most of them, I need to get them from my doctor. I need to see my doctor face to face. He has to live in the town that I'm in, as one example. And so services have definitely been booming. Another reason that services have been booming is, you know, work from home. We've talked about this on these previous calls, and I'll just say it's a thing. It's real. Everybody wants a service job now because you get to work a couple of days at home as opposed to a job that requires you to be on premises. And so that sector is just on fire right now. There's demand. Workers are demanding it, and employers are afraid of losing good workers because of work from home. In other words, what I mean by that is if you're an employee and you work for a company that has a couple of days a week at home and you're a good employee, you're viewed as kind of a unicorn. Hey, you're good. I like you because you work when you're at home or you come in an extra day. If my business turns down, I might not want to lay you off. And that's what we refer to as labor hoarding. And we're starting to see some of that. So yeah, the service sector is definitely on fire.
Now, I want to talk about the next question, which is a Fed pivot. And the idea is inflation comes down. It's been coming down since hitting a peak of 9%. But I'm of the view that it's going to start heating up again, and I'll get to that in a second. But let's talk about the Fed pivot. The markets are anticipating at least two more rate hikes, maybe one coming this month in July, and maybe another one in either September or November. But it doesn't look like they're ready to pivot anytime soon unless something blows up here.
Yeah, so let's look at Fed history. What people think a pivot is, the Fed declares victory and takes their victory lap, and they say, we vanquished inflation and we're going to cut interest rates. And that's not the way it works. Usually when the Fed starts cutting interest rates is when they're panicking. Things are falling apart. We're going into recession. And then they try to stop it. Spring of 2020, the fall of 2007. These are the last times the Fed pivoted, you know, early in 2001. These are the last three pivots. All of them came because the Fed looked at the data and said, the economy's falling off a cliff. We've got to do something. So typically, a Fed pivot is kind of the worst time to own stocks because it's the Fed admitting things are going bad and they're trying to stop them from going bad. And by the way, they never are able to. We always have a recession. The last time the Fed pivoted by declaring victory and said, we vanquished inflation and now we can cut interest rates was 1995. 1994, they raised rates from 3 to 6% because they were fearing inflation. It never materialized. The Fed declared victory in early 1995 and started cutting interest rates. The S&P rallied 37% for the year. One of its best years ever. By 1996, Greenspan was uttering that famous phrase, irrational exuberance, because the stock market just went completely ballistic. And they then tried to spend the next 3 years to rein it in. So no, if they follow their history, they're going to pivot when everything falls apart. They are not going to declare, we have completed the inflation fighting and now we could cut interest rates. They might say we've completed the inflation fighting and hold interest rates steady, but they're only going to cut when they see serious signs that the economy is getting worse. And if they see signs the economy is getting worse and panic enough to cut interest rates, I don't want to be anywhere near risk markets, because if you look at 2008 or the spring of 2020 or even 2001, those were not good times to own risk markets, because they were, earnings were falling, the economy was weakening, and risk markets were under extreme pressure. So be careful what you wish for with the pivot. You're calling for the worst environment to own stocks, because the Fed only does it when things go bad.
You know, we have a saying, they'll keep raising rates until they break something. You know, people thought when we had a couple of banks go under that that was it, but it doesn't seem like that's it yet. So they'll keep raising eventually. You know, I can't help but think of, with all the debt in the economy, something will break further down the road.
Yeah, that's always been the way it works, is that they keep raising interest rates until something breaks. Now, of course, that is, as you pointed out, it's kind of a nebulous term. What is breaks? Is it that the bond market had its worst year in 2022? Is it the stock market corrected 25%? Is it that there was a crisis with UK gilts in the fall of 2022? Was it the banking crisis that we saw? Was it all of the above? And the answer appears to be, for right now, no, none of that was the quote break, which is kind of worrisome, because that suggests something worse is coming. But yes, usually the Fed keeps raising rates, something goes seriously wrong. And that's part of the pivot, that they try to stop when something seriously goes wrong and they can't stop the recession. The Hallmark example of that was they raised rates 17 times, 17 25 basis point rate hikes in 17 meetings from 2004 to 2006 to try and cool the housing market. Well, you did that. And not only did you cool it, you blew it up. And then you wound up realizing what a mess you made. You tried to cut rates to zero by 2008 to try and stop it. And we still had the Great Recession. So they raised rates, they broke the housing market, and then they cut rates to zero to try to unbreak the housing market, and it didn't work. And we still had the great financial crisis in 2008.
I want to move on to inflation. The Fed's goal is 2%. It's been coming down since, what, last March or in the spring. We've come down from 9. We're in that 4% range. But a lot of that had to do with the energy markets coming down. We emptied half of the SPR. Jim, I'm of the opinion that we're going to see inflation start to tick up in the second half of the year. So that's number one. And two, if so, what kind of predicament does that put the Fed in? They can't say, hey, we've taken a victory lap. Do they keep raising?
Yeah. So inflation peaked in June of last year at 9%. And now we're, you know, about a year later. And we've gone from 9% to 4. Most likely, when we get the June numbers in the middle of July, we will see it go down to something like 3% on a year-over-year basis. And I'm with you that I think that that will be the low of inflation. Now, economists have a term for this. It's called the base effect. June of last year, the monthly inflation report was 1.2%. Now, that is a huge number for 1 month, to see prices increase by over 1% for a month. That is almost a 15 or 16% annualized rate, to put it in those terms. And the reason we saw a big number last June was that's when we had $5 gasoline nationwide. And we were all talking about gasoline prices, which is what caused us to open the SPR and drain that to try and get gas prices down. Well, when we drop that number off and we replace it with whatever this June's number was, probably about a 0.4 increase thereabouts, is what the estimates are, the inflation rate will fall to 3% year over year. Then you look at August of 2022's inflation rate, that was zero a year ago because gasoline prices came down a lot. And then July was zero. August was 0.2. If we keep printing 0.3s, 0.4s, 0.5s for the monthly inflation rate like we've seen, the inflation rate will start back up. And by the fall, we could be back near or above 4%. By the end of the year, we might be near 5%. Now, we're not going anywhere near 9. But if we go to 3 and then go back above 4, the Fed will find this as being completely unacceptable. And they say that they're going to give us two rate hikes before the end of the year, one coming in July. 93% chance that the July rate hike will happen, and probably 50-50 that there'll be another one. I think it'll be a virtual certainty that we'll get at least two rate hikes. And I said at least. They might even open the door to another rate hike either before the end of the year or early in 2024. Now, why would the Fed find this unacceptable? I've talked about this before with you. In May, YouGov did a study. 57% of the respondents to their survey or study said they have less than $10,000 of savings. 12% said they have zero, and something like 19% said they have less than $1,000. So over half of the public has less than $10,000 of savings. And the Fed knows this, and they keep talking about the need to get to inflation to 2%, because if we're in a world of 3 or 4% inflation, and we're in a world of 3% raises, meaning prices are rising faster than your paycheck, you go to the store, you buy less things every month because the prices are just outstripping your ability to pay for it. Now, if you're an investor, if you've got some savings, you've seen, you know, your stock market's up 17%, the bond market has rebounded, so you've got some cushion from investment income or investment capital gains to offset that, but these people don't. And so Jay Powell has made mention of this many times. If we don't get rid of inflation, we don't have an economy, we understand the hardships this is causing. These are the words that Jay Powell uses, which is why I think he's singularly focused on getting the inflation rate back to 2%. If that creates hardship for investors, or if that creates higher unemployment, I think the Fed looks at it as, and I think they're correct on this, inflation hurts 100% of the people in the economy. 100%. Everybody's hurt by inflation. But if it takes a rise of unemployment of 1% or 2%, that means 1% or 2% lose their jobs, 98% get price relief. That's better than leaving it the way it is, even though that is a difficult trade-off to make. And I think that that's the way they're looking at it. So the reason I bring that up is that's why if the inflation rate bottoms at 3 and that base effect where the low numbers in July and August and September kick in and we jump over them and the inflation rate starts to trend higher, the Fed will say this is completely unacceptable. We have to get this inflation rate down, and we'll be talking about a lot more rate hikes.
And that brings up the next question, because there's record amounts going into stock index funds by investors. A lot of money is going into the bond fund with long duration with investors, and the stock market's up. And if the Fed keeps raising, eventually this isn't going to be good news for the stock market. So let's move on to the stock market. In your opinion, Jim, is this the beginning of a new bull market? It's the first time I've ever seen one in the Fed rate raising cycle before a recession hits. That's number one. And number two, this bull market in stocks, I've never seen one like this where you have a handful of stocks that are driving the S&P, what do they call it, the Gang of 10 or the NASDAQ. Love to hear your comments here.
Yeah, so a bull market, count me as one of those that believes that the next bull market starts at the old all-time high. So we got to get the S&P back to 4,800 before it's officially a bull market. So it's still a correction. Why is that? Because, you know, you don't want to keep paying for the same real estate over and over again. We already had a bull market when the S&P was going from 43 to 4,400. That was in 2019. We can't have another bull market when it's going from 43 to 4,400. We got to get back to the old high. So what this has been is a giant correction, a big one, no doubt, you know, over 20%, but it doesn't begin until we get to the new all-time highs. Do we get to the new all-time highs? I think you put your finger on what the real issue here is, the concentration of the rally. So if you look at the top 8 or 10 stocks in the S&P, we run this chart regularly on Twitter and some other social media like LinkedIn. The S&P for the year is up something like 13 or 14% without dividends. 10 or 11% of that is 8 stocks. And the other 492 stocks is like 2% of the rally. So you've got arguably the most concentrated rally in the index we've ever seen, that a handful of mega multi-trillion dollar companies that all have something to do with the word letters AI seem to be booming off the top of the page. Everything else is kind of meandering sideways. It's up a little bit this year. Since March, it's not up at all. March is when the banks started to fail. So you've got this giant divergence going on in the market. Will that rally in the market broaden out, that those other stocks will start to gain? If interest rates were to come down, if inflation were to be shown to be something more than a base effect and start to come down, and if the banks were to start to recover. Because one of the things I've noticed about the stock market is if you have a banking system that's in trouble, it's really hard to get the market to rally. Well, wait a minute. Banking system's been in trouble since March, and it's no problem rallying. Yeah, because it's AI stocks that don't need banks. NVIDIA, Apple, Google don't need banks. Everybody else needs a bank for financial services provided by a bank. And that's why the rest of the companies, look at the Russell 2000, it was actually still down on the year until early June. And all of its gain for the year has only come in the last 3 weeks or so. And so those companies, you know, they're not bad, but they're definitely kind of meandering sideways to slightly up. We would need the banks to start to recover. Now, they don't have to lead the banks. They just can't be bad. And they've been bad. Well, if we get interest rates down, if we get inflation showing it's not a problem and stuff like that, then the banks will start to recover. But I don't think they are recovering right now. They're not getting worse. That's good. But they're definitely down a lot and they're meandering sideways. And last offering is another big important sector that has been struggling, almost looking identical to the banks, is office real estate, not just any commercial real estate, but office real estate in particular. A lot of regional banks and a lot of small banks have handed out loans to build the 4-story or 10-story office complex, and they're holding the mortgages on those complexes, and no one's going to the office anymore. They're working from home, so they're only half full, and there's real fear that a lot of these people are going to, you know, terminate their leases. They're not going to be able to release these places. They're going to run into cash flow problems, and that's going to show up with the bank holding these mortgages, which is why office real estate and banks are performing equal to each other, and that is, in this case, equally poor.
You know, the thing that really strikes me, though, about this, I'm looking at Bloomberg screen of Apple. It's worth $3 trillion. It really struck me, Jim, that's almost 80% of the GDP of Germany, the fourth largest economy in the world. I mean, that is stunning.
Yeah. You know, to paraphrase Babe Ruth, I guess Apple had a better year than Germany, right? When he was famously asked why he got paid more than the president of the United States, he quipped that I had a better year. And so it is stunning, but it goes to the mentality and maybe even the reality of where the growth is and where the economy's restructuring is coming. And it's going to be in the deployment of new technologies, either ones we know of like AI or ones that are coming, and the perception that a lot of these big companies are going to be in the forefront of it. Now, I agree with the first half of that wholeheartedly. There is new technologies that are coming that are going to restructure, reorient the economy like we think. And that's not new. We've seen this throughout time. If you want to go all back 100 years ago to the invention of the radio and then the television, then the telephone, you know, color TV, we saw this. But what has always been tricky is you can identify a technology, AI. And that's going to be a transformational technology. Okay, how do I make money on it? Well, sometimes the early plays, like buy NVIDIA, buy Apple, sometimes they don't work out. Other times they do. That's really where the difficulty comes in. So yeah, I understand why Apple's such a big company. It's such an important product. I mean, if you look at your personal life, I look at my personal life, and I have an iPhone, I have an iPad, my kids have iPhones and iPads, my wife has an iPhone and iPad. I'm into that company many, many thousands of dollars with all of that equipment. And I think a lot of people listening to this podcast would probably nod that they are too. And that's why it is such a big company. And that, you know, there's no other company like that. We might be into thousands of dollars for an automobile, but there's all kinds of automobile companies that we might be owning. And it's not just one like Apple would be. So I understand why they're big and I understand the hope, but there can be AI and it can be transformational. And then the question is NVIDIA and Apple the play for it? Or is it a company that is not yet public or maybe doesn't even exist that will come along and be the next play? And I'll remind everybody, after the tech bust in 2000, when tech busted out, people were talking about what's going to get technology to rise again. Well, companies like Google. Google didn't even come public till 2004. So it wasn't even an option after the tech bust from 2001 and 2002. It was years later that these new companies that were going to take advantage of the next wave of technology came. Maybe with AI, it's the same thing. There will be huge opportunities for investors in transformational AI companies. Maybe that AI company doesn't exist right now and it's still to come. Maybe it is Apple and maybe it is NVIDIA. That's the difficulty in investing in those spaces.
And you also have companies like old line companies like Caterpillar that are going to go to self-driving tractors and harvesters. So they're going to apply that technology in their business.
Yes. You know, and everybody's doing it. The FactSet, which puts out a lot of data, looks at conference calls, earnings conference calls, and the use of the word AI has gone parabolic. I mean, you know, everybody, even Subway Sandwiches has started to use the word AI because everybody wants to be associated with it because it increases the valuation of your company. But nevertheless, yes, either it's going to be in supply chain management, which is where Subway was going to use it, or it's going to be with Caterpillar Tractor, which, by the way, I think is a very good application for it because Caterpillar makes those enormous dump trucks and front-end loaders that are the size of a house that usually work in a mine. That's a great application to have self-driving because it's not a busy city where you can run over a lot of people. There are no people to run over. So, you know, if you're just using that in terms of just mining stuff, that's a very good application for it. So I understand why Caterpillar is very excited about that technology.
I want to move lastly to government debt. As we started this program, I mentioned we just hit $32.3 trillion. It looks like we'll probably end up the year at $33 trillion. You've got the Fed raising interest rates. And Jim, I'm looking at my Treasury screen. We've got six-month T-bills at roughly 5.5, 1 year almost close to that. We just had the 2 year cross 5, and then the 10 year and the 30 year are over 4. So, as you mentioned earlier, interest on the debt this year will be more than what we spend on the U.S. military. At what point, and especially with next year being an election year, does this thing start to hit home for the Treasury or the Fed in terms of the rapid growth of debt?
You know, that's a good question. Like I said earlier, that's when it will hit home, first of all, is that the market will say enough, impose discipline on the bond market. You can't keep borrowing like this. It's not quite there yet. For now, interest rates are responding to the prospect that inflation might be bottoming, that the economy, let's call the economy labor, might not be slowing, which will then feed into inflation and the Fed will stay aggressive. That's why you've got, as you pointed out, 5.5 to 5% inside of 2 year maturities on interest rates. And we just went over 4% on the day we're recording again on the 10 year note. So those interest rates will continue to go higher for inflation and growth and Federal Reserve policy reasons. The consequence of them going higher will be that over time, the federal debt will continue to be higher, more and more expensive to pay, and that will eat up a bigger and bigger part of the U.S. budget. Now, it's not a very big part of the budget now. It's something like 6 or 7%. So, you know, 94% out of every tax dollar you spend does not go to paying debt. But in the next couple of years, that can change quite a bit. When will the market pay attention to it? It's interesting you brought up an election year, because a question I get a lot is, doesn't the Fed kind of sit on its hands during an election year? And the answer I always give is they would like to, but often they're not allowed to. Because if you look at the most aggressive periods when the Fed has had to do extraordinary actions, what was the last election? 2020, we had COVID. It was 2008, which was an election year. We had the financial crisis. It was 1992 when the Fed was battling what they thought was an inflation problem. George H.W. Bush wrote in his memoirs, he blames Greenspan for the aggressive hiking that cost him the election in 92. It was 1980 when Jimmy Carter blamed Paul Volcker for raising interest rates to 21% in an election year because they were fighting runaway inflation. So it's interesting. Everybody starts the year in January and says, the Fed's not going to do anything because it's election year. But it always seems that election years are when things are forced upon the Fed to act aggressively. What could be one of the things that is forced upon the Fed to act aggressively next year? It could be this debt situation that you're talking about. Oh, why can't they just deal with it in 25? Because when the market says it's a problem, deal with it, bond yields start up, it starts to impair the economy. The Fed has to react to all of this. If it happens to be like it was in 2008, days before the election that they were doing extraordinary things, then it happens to be days before the election that they're doing extraordinary things. Or if it happens to be in 2020 that the Fed was doing things that were so extraordinary, I remember in the spring of 2020 that I had forgotten that we were having primaries, that those same days that the Fed was cutting interest rates to try and stop the economy from imploding, and that it drowned out the primary season as well. If that's the environment that is forced upon the Fed, then they'll be forced to react. And yeah, the debt thing is not going away. It's only going to get worse. At some point, the markets will turn their attention to the debt ceiling problem. And when they do, it could be very bad. Now, last thought for you, why doesn't the market care about it now? Rick Rieder, who's the chief investment officer at BlackRock, has a great line that summarizes it. And he says, the markets only worry about the shark closest to the boat. You know, and so that's a shark. That's a big shark, big white shark, but it's out there. And we've got other sharks that are closer right now that we have to worry about. But eventually that one will get close to the boat and then we'll have to worry about it. So it's out there, but it's not an immediate problem right now.
So in summary, we don't see anything, at least right now, that's hinting towards a recession. This idea that the Fed will pivot and inflation will come down, I think both you and I agree that's probably not going to happen. We expect inflation and energy prices to rise. Given that, this does not bode well for the market. As an investor, how would you play this, Jim?
Well, I also think it doesn't bode well for the market. And to some extent, I think it hasn't bode well for the market. The bond market has given you positive returns because on the positive side in the bond market is there's a yield again. So you're getting a coupon, you know, of 3 or 4 or 5%. So if prices stay unchanged in the bond market, you still get 4-ish% on a broad basket of bonds. In the stock market, 10 stocks are going through the roof. 490 stocks are kind of meandering sideways, and 2,000 small cap stocks, that's the Russell 2000, are just barely above zero for the year right now. And we're negative on the year like 3 weeks ago. So that's what you've been seeing in the market so far. I think that your best bet in the bond market is probably at the front end of the yield curve. Now, the stock market historically is supposed to give you about a 9% return long term. Okay, I can get 5.5 in a 3-month treasury bill or something very short term that has virtually no risk. I could get 2/3 of the returns that I'm expected to get from the stock market. Well, that's a good place to start right there. Beyond that, if you're more speculative and you want to play in the space of artificial intelligence and technology and the momentum that's got there, there's, like I said, the idea that that's going to be a big deal is probably correct. The question, though, is, are you buying the right companies? You know, another example there would be in 1999, you could have said, I think online retailing is going to be revolutionary. And 20 years later, you were proven 100% right. But in 1999, if you bought the biggest online retailer, bigger than Amazon at the time, it was Pets.com. And a year later, it was at zero. It went out of business. And then this little bookseller named Amazon became worth $2 trillion 20 years later. So that is a place to definitely think about playing, but it's a lot more complicated than people think. But if you're asking about stocks and bonds and everything else, 5.5% yield at a 3-month treasury bill compared to what I would get that's not one of the 10 largest stocks in the US, or compared to small cap stocks, or compared to the broad base in the bond market, that is a very competitive investment right now. And so, you know, I'll take that 5.5%. And if the Fed raises rates, you know, at the end of the month and talks about raising rates again in September, November, that could go well above 5.5% for the rest of the year. And then as I continue to earn that coupon, I could figure out where I want to deploy my money at a later date. So this is kind of like a take what the market's giving you, big fat yields in the front end of the yield curve, and live to fight another day. Now, I'm not going to be there forever, but it's not like 2019 where cash was a zero yielding investment. Cash is now a very competitive yielding investment, and it's worthy of consideration, and it has almost no risk. You know, look, if the treasury defaults on my treasury bill, then that's the last thing I'm going to be worried about. It's good. We're going to be running a Mad Max movie and stocking food cans and getting guns at that point. So that's like I'm trying to be funny by saying that's like the safest possible investment you get, and you're getting a competitive yield with it. So take it if it's offered to you.
All right. Well, listen, Jim, as we close, tell our listeners how they could follow your work. You do some of the best stuff I see that comes out on Wall Street.
Thank you very much. We offer an institutional service at biancoresearch.com. You can request a free trial, but it's a pricey institutional service. I'll warn you up front for those that are interested in it. So it's more oriented towards the professional investor. But to augment that, I try to stay very active on Twitter, and I try to stay very active on LinkedIn by posting some of the ideas that we have and some thoughts for everybody else. So you can follow me at Bianco Research on Twitter, or you could follow me on Jim Bianco is my name on LinkedIn.
All right. Well, listen, Jim, as always, pleasure having you on the program. Have yourself a great rest of the summer and hope to talk to you again.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.